It's Playback Daily for the 1st of July with me, Gemma Craddock. And here's a taste of what's coming up.
Maybe you get Brezzy, Niall Horan, both from Westmeath.
Can you imagine Brezzy singing that song, Westmeath?
I don't think he'd be able for it, no. It'd be something way more soulful and meaningful. But so maybe the two of them together could sing a song for Westmeath. We could have a Eurovision Song Contest for Westmeath.
I think you've hit on something there.
This does not mean that the allegations against him were not true. It does not mean that he's innocent. It's more of a legal technicality.
Now, I'm sorry to do this to you, Dr. Jackie Faherty, because I know it's not a yes-no answer, but we only have time for a yes-no answer. Do you think there is intelligent life out there?
I'll leave that question hanging, and any of you Fox Mulders will have to listen, but let's start here. A tense Dublin noir has turned its creator into a shining star. And on The Ray D'Arcy Show, the writer, director and producer of the movie Broken Law, Paddy Slattery, chatted about the 10 years it took to get his movie made and his delight at his IFTA nomination.
Paddy was motivated to make a mark in the film industry when his life changed profoundly after an accident that made him quadriplegic. I'm doing the sort of the abbreviated version, Paddy. Good to see you again.
How are you doing?
So you were 17. What year was that? Just to remind people.
Oh my God. October 14th,
96.
My life changed, yeah.
25 years ago.
It's crazy, isn't it? Quarter of a century.
Yeah.
It's mad. So, I don't look a day older than 26.
But you're 42.
42 stone.
Listen, the reason we're having you in is because the Irish Oscars, the IFTAs, is on this weekend. And Broken Law has been nominated for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 IFTAs.
Oh my God, it's crazy.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't even have to send a brown envelope to anyone.
Yeah.
It's mad.
Now, people have differing attitudes to awards and award ceremonies.
Yeah.
And some people look down their noses at them. What's your attitude?
I don't know. I think they're an integral part of the industry. They're almost like a validation for, you know, years of work. You've got your peers, people you look up to, basically tipping their hat to your work and sort of welcoming you to the fold. So for that reason, I think it's great to get that recognition from IFTA.
Yeah.
Of course, like, people get caught up in the whole red carpets, champagne and all those shenanigans, and I'm sure that's great crack and all, but yeah, it wouldn't be the reason I'd be motivated to get up out of bed in the morning. Let's just say that way. Yeah.
And talk about motivation, because you must have had to draw deep for motivation over 10 years to make a movie.
Oh my God, yeah. Well, there was many times in those 10 years that I found myself asking, what am I doing? I digged so deep into the resources, energy. I was almost broke mentally, physically, financially, trying to get it done. But somehow, miraculously, over the last couple of years, all those pieces of the puzzle started to fall into place.
And was part of the motivation, you know, the accident and you becoming paraplegic and sort of proving to people?
You know, that is the thing, Ray. It's probably not the healthiest motivation to try and prove people wrong, because the world I was introduced to after that crash was a world that was telling me on a constant basis that I was no longer capable of doing certain things. And I'm the kind of person that if somebody tells me I can't do that, if it kills me, I'll go on my way to try and prove them wrong. So that was my motivation to actually prove that I could do it in the first place.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest now, I was naive at the time to think that I needed to prove myself to anybody else other than myself. But the more I got to know myself, I realized, you know what? I love stories. I love telling stories. And it was film that actually held my hand emotionally going through that. Of course, as well as my family and my friends. But film was my escape. And it almost felt natural to fall into that role, even as a director, because I found I had to actually direct my life in such a way with people helping me in different kind of ways. So I guess one of my skills, if I have any skill, is probably communication with people. And
hugely important when you're a director.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you immersed yourself in film. I was listening back to our two chats. You immersed yourself in film. At one stage, you were watching 3-4 movies a day.
Absolutely.
And that was before Netflix, was it?
Yeah. Honest to God, man. I have about 1,000 DVDs at home.
Right.
And they're all sitting there now, almost obsolete, gathering dust. But yeah, I was just went down the rabbit hole of cinema. And Because I'd never
talk
done that.
Talk me through
prior.
How you watched them. Like, cause you were watching them not like your average person who sits down to watch a movie on the sofa with a bowl of popcorn. You were taking them apart, forensically sort
Absolutely.
Of analysing them.
Well, the good thing about DVDs, if anyone remembers, initially when they came out, you could get the special features on them. So when I did eventually somehow got this notion that I wanted to make films, I would sort of get lost in the special features and the director commentaries and behind the scenes documentaries. And that was my film school, because, I mean, I didn't do film school, you know, go that traditional route. But it's all there. And YouTube, of course, then came into 2004. So that was, I mean, free education online.
Yeah. And now Netflix, you can watch anything.
Now you can watch Broken Law on Netflix. It's crazy.
Oh, it's on Netflix.
I mean, they put that on Netflix nowadays, wouldn't they?
Look, I told you the last time you were in, because I watched it and I watched a bit of it again just to remind myself. Like, it's a great movie. It's a great movie.
Thanks, man.
So it's two brothers, just to remind people, sort of both of them, one's on the right side of the law in that he's a member of An Garda Síochána Síochána, and his brother's just out of prison. And that's sort of the tension and the storyline that brings you through it.
Well, that's it. We discover, you know, we might have our loyalties to our work or our professions or whatever, but at the end of the day, our true loyalties are to our family, our blood. You know, that's what's most important in life. Yeah.
So what is the IFTAs this year? Is it virtual? There won't be any red carpet or champagne, or will there be?
Well, don't worry, we'll have champagne. It'll be on standby. I'll have my family off camera. But yeah, we all have to do it from the safety of our homes, through Zoom links and that kind of stuff. So unfortunately, we won't have the big shindig in the Mansion House this year. But look, next year.
Like, it's as you're saying, validation. It's a huge validation for you. You know, best film, best director, and you're getting Rising Star as well. Script, you wrote the script. So, one, two, and I know a movie is a team effort, you know, but you were the driving force, so you can take credit for the fact that it made it to the cinema. You obviously directed it, you wrote the script, and then you're named as a Rising Star. So, in Rising Star, they can have actors or directors or whatever.
Absolutely.
It's just somebody who's new to the scene.
That's it, yeah. And to be honest, Ray, we didn't have money. Like, we raised the money ourselves to make it. So our cast and crew basically gave us their time almost pro bono, you know, to get it done and that. So it literally wouldn't have those nominations if not for those guys. And like John Desai, for example, is my editor. And I love him to bits. He's like a brother. And we've been working from 10 years ago at the very beginning of the process. And so we'd sort of built that sort of family unit in our own intimate crew as we came along. So we were all working toward the promise of having our big movie experience. Yeah. So we were all chasing that same dream, you know. It was brilliant.
So you had the premiere. We talked about that. And now you have the award ceremony, which is like you were saying before we went on air that it seems a bit unreal, and that you might look back in 10 years' time and maybe go, oh, now I appreciate what I was going through then.
Yeah.
Is there any way of making sure that you appreciate it now, Paddy?
Oh, believe me, man, I can't sleep at night. I appreciate it that much. It feels like I'm living a dream, but it's always felt like that. And I've always said that I'm a bit philosophical when it comes to the definition of success. For me, if I wake up in the morning and I have air in my lungs, that for me is my definition of success. Yeah. Everything else for me is consequential. It's sort of a byproduct of my own mental state going into every day. And that's my mantra every morning when I wake up. And like, I work hard, right? I'm dedicated to what I do. And I put that almost selfishly, I kind of put that before everything else over the last 10 years. So it's almost a natural outcome that we see this. And people have asked me, did you ever dream, or did you ever expect you'd be, you know, having your movie on Netflix and in the cinema and all these awards? And I'll be honest, Ray, and I don't mean this in an arrogant way, at the very beginning, I did believe I could achieve this. And if I didn't believe it, I probably wouldn't have went down that road in the first place. And you have to believe in yourself, especially when other people don't believe in you. Mm. And I've always held firm to that belief.
You have not a unique, but you have a minority worldview in that you became quadriplegic when you were 17.
Yeah.
And what I love about you is your positivity and your can-do attitude. And I'm not saying that in a patronising way at all. I'm in awe of you. And I'm sure there are other people who are in awe of you as well. And people who seek you out, I'd imagine, for advice, do they?
They do indeed, yeah. I actually, over the last few years, because I've had a bit of a reputation for doing talks in schools and colleges, that kind of stuff. And I love that. I love the fact that
How did that start, Paddy?
Oh, my God. I think my PA at the time, PJ Deering's daughter, was a teacher. And she invited me into a school. And then another teacher who's a friend of a friend. And then my name ended up on this list in Ireland for sort of a top 10 or a top 100 list of guest speakers. And I was always told by the schools I went, I'm top 2 on that list of the most right. popular speakers. And you know who's number Ooh. 1? A sort of a concentration camp, Auschwitz survivor.
Oh, yes. We've spoken to him loads of times.
Incredible guy.
Tommy Reichenstahl.
That's the guy,
who's an amazing guy.
Oh my God, I'm sorry I never got to see him speak. Yeah. But so I was up there in good company, you know.
Right. You and Tommy Reichenstahl.
They are unbelievable, yeah. And like my life wasn't as dramatic as his.
But you have overcome quite a substantial adversity.
But you know what's extraordinary, Ray? And I'm sure this man can relate to it. Like for me, when my body was paralyzed, that was the moment I was actually liberated in my life. That was the moment my body switched off and my imagination switched on. And I didn't seek outward to, different external adventures. I went back into myself and I realized that there was this whole universe of unexplored, worlds of imagination. Yeah. And that's where the real adventure began for me. And that sounds crazy, but I might never have had that opportunity if I wasn't struck down with that paralysis at that time.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Like
that's you see, we're going to have to spend hours talking because that there, what you've just said there, opens up a whole discussion.
Absolutely,
because it is. Are you rationalising that to keep you positive, or it's there's loads of things.
Look,
and I suppose you've done the what ifs. Like, if that didn't happen, would you still have been a director of movies that was waiting for the ifs this week after being nominated six categories? You do that on a regular basis. Do you?
If I didn't do that, I wouldn't be human.
Yes, it's part of the human condition, isn't it?
It's in our nature, absolutely. Yeah. But as far as I'm concerned, look, I'm sitting here chatting with Ray Darcy, a hero of mine from the time I was about 6 years of age. I don't want to make you feel old now, Ray, but this is a huge honour, you know what I mean?
Go on, stop. Paddy spoke to the TY group in our school, amazing, inspirational man, unstoppable, congratulations and well deserved, says Josephine McCardle in Tullamore College. So listen, good luck.
Thank you
at the weekend. Good luck at the weekend. So Broken Law is up there on Netflix and it's been nominated for Best Film, Best Director, Best Script, Best Actor in a Lead Role, Tristan Hyanu, is it? Is that how you pronounce it?
Tristan Hyanu. Amazing actor, yeah.
Actress in a supporting role, Ali Nikiron and Rising Star yourself.
Thanks.
Great to see you, Paddy.
Filmmaker Paddy Slattery on The Ray Darcy Show. Now, Ryan Tubridy and the Muppets. Any joke there is low-hanging fruit. But our very own Guy Smiley today described his delight at receiving a handmade puppet straight out of the Jim Henson wheelhouse. He then spoke to the maker, 16-year-old Ruan Gormley from Galway, who described the process of making a monster.
Well, he's made from reticulated foam. The skull in the head is patterned reticulated foam, and then he's covered in fur. And the arms are a nylon fleece, which is sort of, it's a fleece you can hide seams really well on, so the Muppets use that.
And should I, did he come with a name, or should I name him, or?
Oh no, it's up to you to name him.
It's up to you. And why did you send him?
Well, I thought it was really good that there was another Muppet fan out there who enjoyed the Muppets as much as I did, so I thought you'd like the puppet.
Well, thank you, you recognise that, because I've been a fan since I was about 7 or 8. How old are you now?
I am 16.
So you get it. What do you think it is? It's quite hard to explain to people. Why are these men talking about Muppets like they're both 8 years old? What is it about the Muppets that you find so charming and attractive and funny?
Well, I love the humour. The humour is very smart, and I love them. Also, the character designs are very good as well.
Which ones are your top?
Oh, I really like Miss Piggy, and I like Gonzo.
Okay, and in terms of Muppetry, broadly speaking, how did you get into making them? Because I've seen footage of you with some of your creations. They're amazing. Where did this come from?
Well, a few years ago, my mum got me a book. It was called The Muppets Make Puppets, and I learned that Jim Henson used to make puppets when he was very young, so I thought I'd have a go at it as well.
Brilliant. And do you watch other programs that have Muppets in them on TV?
Oh, yeah. I watch the new Spitting Image and Dark Crystal and things like that.
Right. Dark Crystal. And broadly speaking, then, the Jim Henson world and Muppetry, the Sesame Street and that. Is that where you'd like to go?
Yes,
and
definitely.
Have you made any inroads in that way, or have you tried to contact them?
Kind of. Over the lockdown, my uncle helped me post a video on Twitter of one of my puppets lip-syncing to a song, and one of the puppeteers who works on Sesame Street now saw it.
Oh, very good. And what happened? Anything come of that?
Well, his name is Warwick Brownlow Pike, and he plays Gonger on Sesame Street, and we've kind of kept in touch since then.
Well, so it begins. I mean, that would be great. The creations that you've come up with Muppet-wise are carved straight out of the Muppet, the Henson playbook. So you're really really excellent at what you do, I have to say. How does it go down at school?
Everyone really, really likes the puppets. I bring them in once a week if I can for such things. Like I did my CBA on that, the classroom-based assessment for English, and that went down pretty well.
Well, what did you do?
I did a presentation on the Muppet style of puppeteering, and I brought in some of my Muppets.
And used them to illustrate what they do?
Yes.
How amazing. So would you bring Muppets into school a fair bit, or just the odd time?
There wasn't much of an opportunity to bring them in this year.
Like,
I brought them in a few times, but because of COVID, I kind of felt it was a bit...
Yeah, just hold off
after being safe. But they came in a few times this year, so that was nice.
Did you ever see Avenue Q?
I saw it in Dublin 2 years ago.
And how did you find it? Did you enjoy it?
Oh, it's such a good show.
Did you bring a friend with you?
Yes, I made a Trekkie monster. He's one of the characters from Avenue Q. I made a puppet of him. And I brought him backstage with me, so he got to meet the cast.
Brilliant. Okay, you in your letter that you wrote to me with your Muppet, which I have upstairs, you said you quote Walter, and you say, "As long as there are singing frogs, joking bears, Swedish chefs, and boomerang fish, the world can't be that bad of a place."
Ryan Tuberty's chat with Ruan Gormley, ending with the words of Walter the Muppet, poet and philosopher. And remember that if you have any little David Walliams fans at home, the much-loved author will be answering questions on Friday morning on the show. Send them to ryan@rte.ie. As if rivalry on the pitch wasn't enough, there's also a scramble to claim the title of Best County Song. On Today with Claire Byrne, singer Cleona Hagen and writer Billy Keane waxed lyrical about the top contenders. But what makes a great county song? And are there any rules?
There aren't. I think one of the best rules is you can sing along to it, you know, like the Rose of Tralee, obviously, my own county. You know, everyone joins in the Pale Je. Nobody says that in Kerry. It's Jet Pale Moon was rising.
Jet Pale Room. And okay, that's a good rule.
Everyone joins in, and they are, like, the boys from the county Armagh up Cliona's direction, not too far away from her. That's a great join-in song,
yeah.
You know, especially in a pub.
So they're the ones that you can sing along
to.
We're going to hear some of them in a moment. But Cliona, do you have any set and fast rules? Because you're the person performing these songs. What are the best ones? What are the ones that work?
You know, for me, within the Irish country sing, the amount of county songs that I sing it's unbelievable because people cry out for the songs. As Billy said, you know, everyone wants to sing along with the songs and not only that, dance to them. So for me, the county songs that really work are, I suppose, upbeat songs, but also, I suppose, not only that, the slow waltzes are beautiful too, like My Home to Donegal, it's just a beautiful song everyone sings along to. And I don't think there's any recipe for a great county song. It's
it's a mystery mix.
Definitely.
You want to be able to sing along,
I could write one.
Dance along, but you also want to be able to put your hand on your heart and have that county patriotism going, you know. Let's listen to your one, will we, Billy?
The Rose of Tralee.
The Rose of Tralee.
Yeah, the only problem is who wrote it.
Yes, well, we'll get to that.
There's
now
a big dispute about it, but listen, they'll be in an awful state in Kerry after this.
Okay, let's go. The cool shades of evening, her mantle was spreading, and Mary all smiling, sad listening to me. The moon through the valleys, her pale rays were shedding, when I won the heart of the Rose of Tralee. Let's see it. She was lovely and fair, like the rose of the summer. It was not her beauty alone that won me. Oh no, t'was the truth in her eyes, ever dawning, that made me love Mary, the Rose of Tralee. Billy's swaying. But there's a row. There's a dispute over.
A small bit emotional as well.
Really?
Seriously, yeah. I was just thinking, like, we're in the All-Ireland again. And we'd all be singing that someplace. Yeah, there's a row.
You might have a wait there, will you?
No, Claire. No, we're getting a bit better now. At least everyone's, nearly the whole country, except Dublin, doesn't want Molly Malone to win. And, you know, when that song came out for years, I used to sing it. And I got it. You know, when you're a young lad, well, you were never a young lad, but you know, when you're younger, I got the words wrong, and it was, she died of a fever because no one would squeeze her. And I thought it was for years. And I was in a big load. I was in the middle of a big load of dubs, and they all came out to me. Oh, yeah, the Rose of Tralee.
Yes,
sorry.
Rose of Tralee and the dispute.
Anyway, the song was written, most people would say, by William Pembroke Mulchinock. And it was about Mary O'Connor, which is my mother's name. And she died, and he came home and found out she was dead, and it was very sad. An awful lot of the county songs that people are roaring and shouting at matches are actually love songs, strangely enough. But this fella called Mordaunt Spencer, I'd say he was a low type. Anyway, he apparently copied the song, and Dr. Nini was called in by the Rose of Tralee Committee in 2019, and they said that it looked like he nicked the song, but more than likely it was William Pembroke Mulchinock who wrote it, and someone else put the music to it later on. But it's a bit of a dispute.
Gosh, it is.
I'd say if the Mordaunt Spencer's family could come forward with any proof, we'd take it on. But in the meantime, we'll sing it with gusto.
So
every time we win.
To come back to you and your own experience, where you're from, you always have to sing the county songs yourself.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I love that. I remember I was actually singing at a marquee down in Leitrim a few years back, and I didn't realise that I don't really follow football that much. I actually know nothing about sports. But they won the championship, and of course I was like, oh my goodness, I need to learn Lovely Leitrim. So basically, I only had a few hours. I learned the song. I was holding a book on stage with the words on it. And I said to the audience, you know, just learned the song, but I have to do this for you to congratulate you all for winning today. And I sang Lovely Leitrim, and I couldn't believe it because I just sang it with just a cappella, and everyone sang along. And there was probably about 600 people in the marquee.
Oh, sure. Listen, and I'd say they loved you for that.
Oh, my goodness. The feeling that I actually got as well, it was unbelievable, because everyone was just so proud to be from Leitrim and from their county, and that is the power of county songs.
Where you're from yourself in Tyrone?
Yes, well, there's a beautiful song called The Old Cross of Arbroath, and it's hundreds and hundreds of years old now. They don't know who actually wrote it, but the song is basically written about the surrounding areas of Tyrone, and they make reference to the old cross of Arbroath. And Arbroath, I live in Balladerry, so Arbroath's only 5 minutes away from where I live. And there's this beautiful, beautiful big cross which stands at the entrance to a cemetery, monastery and a church from the 17th century. So it's absolutely beautiful. And I remember when I was growing up, you know, my granny would have sang it, and my aunts and all, when we would have got round, everyone round for parties, whatnot, they always would have sang the song. And I never learned the song, but growing up, I heard it that much that unbeknownst to myself, I just knew all the words. Mm-hmm. So it's a gorgeous song, and I've got really, really lovely memories from my childhood of that song in particular.
Yeah, these ones go in via osmosis, I think. We have a little bit of this to listen to now. This is the Old Cross of Ardbow, Philomena Begley singing.
Since gone at last, long years have passed, I'll toast this beauteous isle. The verdant shamrock rolls green o'er my grave by Lochnay's wave near the old cross of Ardbow.
Moving to Armagh, Billy. You've picked one. This is a waltz, is it? Or
yeah, there's the Boys from the County Armagh.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great sing-along, but I wonder, will they have to change it now to the Boys and Girls and Others from the County Armagh? Because there's a lot. They wanted to change the name of the Kerrymen lately, the Kerrymen newspaper. The Boys from the County Armagh is the ultimate sing-along song. It's probably my favourite. Everyone knows the words. You know, in a big crowd, you know... Everyone joins in and they stand up on the tables and clap in the hands.
You know, with some songs, though, people might not realise that they're associated with a county. And we have an example, don't we, in Sligo?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Down by the Sally Gardens, which was written by W.B. Yeats. And that was the song for years. And then there was a couple of other songs came out from Sligo to compete with it. Sometimes you have two or three county songs and they'd all be fighting for prominence, but the Sally Gardens Yeats has to be the one, you know, and they play it in Croke Park a lot as well, the Artane Boys band, when Sligo get there.
Well, look, I think this is it's a good excuse, isn't it, to hear it? Yeah. And this is a lovely version from Clannad.
She
it's a love song. There's so many love songs. It's funny, in other countries, the Marseillaise, the French national anthem, which is their rousing song that they play at the rugby or soccer or whatever, it's all about killing people and stabbing them. But in Ireland, we sing love songs. I think we're better lovers than fighters, maybe. That could be
That's no bad thing.
That's no harm. No, no.
Cliona, can you sing these songs anywhere, or do you have to be careful about sensitivities, rivalries and so on?
I don't think so. I think people, you know, at the end of the day, understand that everyone is proud to be from their county. And funny enough, a few years back, I was over in Scotland singing, and I decided to sing Home to Donegal, and not thinking that anyone would know the song. And I couldn't believe that, you know, the whole crowd started singing along. You know, it's just all these songs seep through not only all our own counties, but to other countries as well. But no, I haven't come across any time I sing any of these county songs. Everyone sings along and everyone just wants to have a good time. And these songs are all really iconic at this stage, and they're good songs to sing along with, and everyone loves these songs.
Fiddlers, well, you mentioned Donegal. Let's have a listen to Goldstone Shave and Hills of Donegal. This one is a huge one of late, isn't it?
Oh, my favourite.
You may talk about Atlantis, how it's lost beneath the sea, and the grave of the unknown soldier, or the cry of the Banshee. Who was the man in the iron mask? Was Jack the Ripper set free? But ask them all, was Donegal? It's still a mystery.
I'm just laughing here. I'm interrupting this. But I'm laughing at this message that came in for you, Billy. You can tell Billy that you won't need the Rose of Tralee this year up the Dubs. I was waiting for that one. But listen, my issue is just listening to that song about Donegal, which is great, and there's lots of great songs about Donegal, but there are so many songs about Donegal and so many songs about Kerry.
Yeah.
And what about everyone in the middle?
Well, in the middle, especially in the Midlands, Westmeath There was their song is the Westmead Bachelor.
Yeah.
It's about an old bachelor, 63 years of age, which I think is the prime of life by coincidence.
Yes.
And it's a song written about an old bachelor, and he was giving out about the women. Some
trying
of the lines,
to catch him.
This is one line. With the red stuff on her fingernails and the varnish on her toes, the rattle on her old face hog and the whitewash on her nose. He's giving out about the women. But the rattle, by the way, I just discovered today, is what they mark the sheep with.
Oh, so, God.
And okay. Her fizz hog is her face.
But you know what? The interesting thing about that is Malachy Clarkin was writing about this in the Irish Times, and he said in 2019...
I read it.
So the Westmeath Camogie team at intermediate level won the All-Ireland, and this was the song, and we're going to hear it now from Joe Dolan, that they played to celebrate their victory.
Sure, I am a Westmead bachelor, me age is 63. I don't intend to marry or to raise a family. Sure, I'm happy and contented just to live a single life. And that's the reason why I don't intend to take a wife off.
With the red stuff on her fingernails and varnish on her toes.
See, I don't think that the women who were playing on the Camogie team, that they decided that that song should be played. I'm not sure who decided, but we've got to question the appropriateness of that.
It was written by Bill Whelan. Not Bill Whelan from Riverdance, but Bill Whelan, who was a postman in Castletown Gagan. And he was, you'd hear him before he'd arrive, I was told. He'd be singing to himself up in the bike, the old style postman. And he wrote that song. And I'd say it was meant to be a funny song. But when when the Camogie girls went out, I don't think they were too offended. But if they were looking for something more uplifting, maybe we could have a song for Westmead competition. But I wouldn't write that off. It was of its time, you know. Maybe you'd get Brezzy, Niall Horan, both from Westmead.
Can you imagine Brezzy singing that song?
I don't think he'd be able for it. No, it'd be something way more soulful and meaningful. But so maybe the two of them together could sing a song for Westmead. We could have a Eurovision Song Contest
idea.
For Westmead.
I think you've hit on something there.
And you know what? We could judge it. We'd have a great
we'll
day.
We'll judge it. Myself, yourself, and Cliona.
It's great fun to be had in Westmead always.
Cliona,
we have to bring Cliona as well.
Of course, yeah. The three of us are going to judge this.
This
is our next. Our next project.
I'd be doing some boasting to my pals.
We're not going to head though north again, Cliona, aren't we? We're going to County Down now.
Yes, we are indeed to County Down. You know, the star of the County Down. It's a song sung by the Irish Rovers, and I think for me, the melody of it really, really sticks out. Not only obviously you can sing the song, but I've heard so many instrumentals of this song, and you just when you hear the music starting, you just want to get up on your feet, dance, and it's such a wonderful song, and I can understand why it has stood the test of time.
As she onward spit, sure, I scratched me head, and I looked with the feeling rare. And I says I to a passerby, who's the mate with the nut brown hair? Well, he looked at me and he said to me, "That's a gem of Ireland's crown. Young Rosie McCann from the banks of the Bann, she's the star of the County Down. From Bantry Bay up to Derry's Gay, from Galway to Dublin Town. No maid I've seen like the fair Colleen, and a maid in the County Down."
It's a good one, Billy. That's up there,
that's
isn't it?
It's a great sing along. And again, it's a love song, Rosie McCann. I'd say she must have been a great girl when they went to all that trouble to write a song about her from the banks of the Bann.
Yeah,
but that's a great one. Yeah, I still prefer the boys from the County Armagh, maybe.
Okay, and you're in your league table.
I love that one. Yeah,
a listener says, "Come on, you Lily Whites, awful cringe, but we love it down here."
The Cora of Kildare is another great song.
Yes, Leitrim can't beat hearing "Lovely Leitrim" at the end of a match. You see, that's it, isn't it? It doesn't really matter. "Lovely Leitrim" is a grand song, but it doesn't really matter about the song if you've won something, and it's about where you're from.
It's community, and there's emotion involved in it. I always feel with the Rose of Tralee, you know, you might have been there in Crow Park when you were 7 or 8, hoisted over the turnstile, sitting up in your dad's lap, and all of a sudden then you have, you know, you're doing it yourself. And it's brilliant, like, but Kerry will win the All-Ireland this year, Kerry. I can see your cynicism here, but we will win it. And
sure,
you'll have me back on the Monday afterwards. I'll be slightly hungover, but look, I'll appear anyway.
I note that you're not mentioning where I'm from, so I can't afford to be cheeky here.
Great people always. Yeah, great people always.
Helen says, listening to the Westmeath Bachelor is the only smile I've had all week. I'm neither a bachelor nor from Westmeath, but she enjoyed it all the same. One of the best known country songs, Cliona, was not even written by an Irish writer, Steve Earle and the Galway Girl.
Yeah, what a song. It's you know, I was actually reading up about the background of it, and Steve Earle obviously is an American songwriter and he was living in Ireland at the time, and I saw that Sharon Shannon as well played on the song, and she said that Steve wanted to record it with some of the musicians he had been hanging around with in Galway to make it more authentic. And of course, then later on, there was a very successful version sung by Irish singer Mundy, mm-hmm. and it became the country's biggest selling download in 2008. And it's such a fun song, personally myself, to sing. I always love it. I have so much fun with it. And the song is about a guy meeting a girl in Galway, and they have a brief liaison, but she leaves him with a broken heart, and I take it home.
Okay, another love song.
And they're all broken hearted ones. Either someone dies and the man is heartbroken, or else she left him, the Galway girl left him. Do you know what? It's like a Lonely Hearts Club.
Yeah, well, I keep saying...
Crow Park is like a Lonely Hearts Club sometimes.
I keep saying country songs when we're talking about county songs, yeah. But actually they have that vibe, don't they?
The country, I love country and I love Cliona as well, and I just love to... I love to sing along, and they tell a story. See, country songs, like it's they always tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And these songs tell a story, and maybe that's what attracts us to it, that it's just an extension of the old tradition of storytelling.
Well, let's have a listen to Steve Earle's version of Galway Girl.
I took a stroll on the old long walk of the day. I met a little girl and we stopped to talk of a fine soft day. And I asked your friend, what's a fella to do? Taking a whirl around a salty prime with a Galway girl.
Oh. Never tire of that. You know, it's a great one.
Black hair and blue eyes is a very strange combination, isn't it? It's usually blonde hair and blue eyes.
Now, we're getting text messages from the people. Cliona, I knew this was going to happen. The counties that we haven't mentioned, Slieve na Mon, what about Tip, says somebody. But I mean, sure, you've sung all of them, have you? Pretty much all of them.
Yeah, I've sang so many of all of the county songs, and you know, obviously there's some that maybe be requested more, but that's not to say that, you know, there are so many songs that people want to hear. And you know, just chatting about the county songs, and the country songs, I really believe that the county songs, there's a kind of a blur with country and county songs, because they. Everyone who within the Irish country music scene always has numerous county songs within their sets, and you know, there's so many wonderful ones songs out there, and yeah, I just love singing as many as I can. I need to learn more, truth be told, but there are so many wonderful ones out there for sure.
Well, we can give you a list, because all of our texters are getting in touch with the ones that we haven't mentioned. You wanted to give a few honourable mentions, Billy, to the ones that we haven't played.
Well, Slieve na Mon is one of my favourites.
Is it?
But Tip are playing Clare next Sunday in Ennis in the Munster Hurling Championship. Savage rivalry. Like they're not only touching each other, the two counties, you go over bridges and everything. But there's a song, the Clare song is A Long, Long Way From Clare to Here. But A Long Way to Tipperary is not the Tipperary song, because it was an old British Army recruiting song. So instead they went for Slieve na Mon, mm-hmm. which is probably the most beautiful song. But it's Alone, All Alone by the Wave Washed Down. It's another song about love not working out and sorrow and misfortune. But when we sing it like if Tip win the All-Ireland, we sing it like as if it is the greatest triumph of all time. And you might be right about that. The words mean not that. It's more the occasion.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
The sense of the song being part of mm-hmm. us and who we are.
And any other honourable mentions? Cliffs of Dooneen?
Well, yeah, the Cliffs of Dooneen is a famous Clare song, but it's actually a Kerry song.
Oh, I walked listen, yesterday. You're claiming everything.
No,
you
Dunedin is in Kerry. It's actually in Kerry. I walked it yesterday. And it's near Ballybunion.
Can no you place believe this?
And Spancel Hill, then it's the other Clare song. But it's too long to sing. Like, how could you sing Spancel Hill in Crow Park?
I just think that is a...
My brother, my favourite line song. Is, my brother James got a belt of a hymns.
And that's a good way to leave it, I think. The Westmeath Bachelor, he won today anyway, for sure.
Oh, hands down, hands down.
Billy Keane and Cleona Hagen on Today with Clare Byrne. As I sit here in my studio, I sometimes wonder... Is anyone out there? And it seems Ray Darcy was feeling contemplative too, but he looked a little further afield, chatting about aliens. We spend a lot of time looking to the heavens for signs of life, but could we be the ones being watched? Ray was joined by Dr. Jackie Faherty, an astrophysicist from the American Museum of Natural History.
In a new report, astronomers have drawn up a short list of nearby star systems where any inquisitive inhabitants, i.e. aliens, on orbiting planets would be well placed to spot life on Earth. Dr. Jackie Faherty is how she pronounced it, an astrophysicist at the American Museum of Natural History and co-author of the report, joins me now from the United States of America. Hello, Jackie.
Hi there, Ray. How's it going?
Good to talk to you. You say Faherty, we say Faherty. Let's call the whole thing off.
I like the way you say it, yeah. So I'm good with it.
Great. Okay, this is interesting because the talk up until now has been about us looking out. So what you've done with your colleagues is imagined if people out there were looking back at us. Isn't that it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's kind of a simple problem in some ways, but one which, you know how sometimes if you look at a problem from a different perspective, mm-hmm. you can learn an enormous amount. Mm-hmm. And that was in part some of the motivation here, because it's true what you see splashed across the news always in space science is the worlds that we're discovering, the worlds that we look out, you know, we look out on our nighttime sky, astronomers are out there studying the stars and we're finding planets and we find them everywhere. And then we get excited and we think, okay, what's the next step? What do we do next to try and figure out if there is life in one of these places that we've now discovered? And we kind of sat back for a second and said, we're doing this in earnest in our current stage of the evolution of humans on this planet. Now, what would it look like from the perspective of a star somewhere else? And if they turned and looked, and A, how many people, how many civilizations could detect us? Who would that be? How close are they? And this is a critical part to our study, how long do we remain in a position where they could detect us through a very specific method, which is kind of the prime method that astronomers are using right now, something called the transit method. So we wanted to know how many, we wanted to know where they were, and we wanted to know how long you could hold that vantage point for.
Okay.
So that was the main part of our study.
So to simplify it and put it in the vernacular, Dr. Jackie Faherty, it's about line of sight, isn't it?
It's everything is about perspective. I think one of the things that we can forget often when we're looking up at the sky is that it's three-dimensional, it's multidimensional. You know, the stars just look like points of light out there, but they're giant balls of gas that are inclined in their orbits as they're kind of moving around the galaxy. Mm. And we are also, specifically, we're kind of moving across our sun in a specific way.
Yeah.
And we needed to line up that lineup that we have of the way that the Earth is lined up across the basically how our star is lined up as it's moving across the galaxy. We took that line of sight and we projected across the cosmos. And we said, okay, what stars are in this tiny window of a lineup that we have? And then we ran time forward and backwards. And we said, what stars enter and exit that perfect vantage point, that stadium seating over a plus or minus 5,000 year period. So 10,000 years is what we looked at.
So how many possible planets around possible stars could be seeing us and keeping an eye on us and monitoring us?
Yeah, so we cut the distance to the stars. We relegated ourselves to a little over 300 light year radius. So already the number of stars that were even going to be considered was only 331,000.
Only,
so that was the initial input. I know. It sounds like a lot and a little to me because we could have started with 1.7 billion.
Okay, right,
but we decided to go with the narrower sample of 331,000. And then that immediately was cut down when we started to look at the window, and it came down to 2,034 stars that are currently or were in the past in a position. And that felt both to me like I got like that weird, uncomfortable feeling like somebody's watching you.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you kind of feel naked a little bit, but that felt like a lot. And some of those are very close by, very, very close by stars that have had the vantage point where they could have detected us through this method.
Okay, this is going to melt everyone's heads, bar yours and your colleagues. But they may be watching us. If they were, but they may be watching us from a different time. They may be just getting signals from 50 years ago, or, you know, so they could be watching some black and white television program from the 1950s,
right,
Jackie Gleason or whatever, and thinking that's the level we've reached.
Yeah, so when you look out at the stars, you're not seeing them as they are right this second. You're seeing, because light takes a bit of time to travel. Light moves at 300,000 kilometers a second or thereabouts. And the distances that we're talking about are trillions of kilometers. So it takes years for the light to reach us depending on where the star is. And like I said, we limited it to a 300 light year radius, in part because we wanted to think practically, which is kind of the way that we're thinking about it. Now, is it possible? I mean, it's kind of crazy the way we think about it, but it was.
Will you give us a practical example then of, say, if we send out a message now, right? Say, I've put together just three bits of audio that if there's anybody listening, okay. So I'm going to play this for them because when people are asked what's their favorite sound in the world, this always is up in the top two or top three. So here we go. So they're hearing that, right?
Adorable.
They're thinking, right? Yeah, and then just a sort of some of our popular culture.
There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds.
There you go. The lyrics are perfect. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he knows he'd blow our mind. And finally, some you know, higher end culture. Our own, the late Seamus Heaney. Him reading his poem, Blackberry Picking.
Late August, given heavy rain and sun for a full week, the blackberries would ripen. At first, just one, a glossy purple clot, among others, red, green, hard as a nut. You ate that first one, and its flesh was sweet like thickened wine. Summer's blood was in it, leaving stains upon the tongue and lust for picking.
So, if there's somebody monitoring what we're talking about and playing today, when are they hearing it or when will they hear it in the future?
Well, the closest object in our full sample is an object called Wolf 359, and it is currently in a perfect position.
Okay.
And it would take 7.9 years for it to get that signal that you just launched off into the radio waves. It will take it almost 8 years to reach that star.
Right.
I mean, that's not so bad.
Now, I'm sorry to do this to you, Dr. Jackie Faherty, because I know it's not a yes-no answer, but we only have time for a yes-no answer. Do you think there is intelligent life out there?
I definitely, definitely do.
So, in 8 years' time approximately, they will hear that we know that they're listening or something. Dr. Jackie Faherty on The Ray D'Arcy Show. Ah yes, another day, another crushing blow for women. News arrived from stateside that 83-year-old comedian Bill Cosby's sexual assault conviction had been overturned by a Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And in a court in Los Angeles, a judge has denied Britney Spears' request to remove her father from his role overseeing her conservatorship. Joining Claire Byrne today was entertainment journalist KJ Matthews, who took us through the details leading up to Cosby's 2018 trial.
Remember, there were dozens and dozens of women that came forward that made allegations against Bill Cosby, saying that they were drugged and then sexually assaulted, obviously against their own will. However, there was only enough evidence for one case to come forward in the state of Pennsylvania to be prosecuted because of the statute of limitations and a lack of physical evidence in some of the other cases that were there. The problem with him being charged and ultimately convicted was that a lot of people didn't realize that the state DA, district attorney during that time, told him if he would come in and give a deposition about the particular case that was in front of him involving Andrea Constan under oath, that he would not be prosecuted, no matter what he said. Well, he came in, he gave a deposition, he talked about the fact that, yes, he did use drugs, he did use Quaaludes, and that he did have sex with them and wanted to have sex with Andrea Constan. Shortly after that, he was prosecuted, he was charged, obviously, and then convicted and sent to prison. What the state Supreme Court said on Wednesday is that Bill Cosby should have never been prosecuted in the first place because of the deal that the district attorney had made with him and his attorneys. So it was wrong for him to be prosecuted in the first place. This does not mean that the allegations against him were not true. It does not mean that he's innocent. It's more of a legal technicality is what it is.
Okay, and his conviction then in 2018 when it happened, and we think about that time, it was a landmark moment, wasn't it, in the Me Too movement?
Absolutely. Remember, we had Harvey Weinstein and a dozen other people in Hollywood that were basically ostracized, if not charged, and went away. But they definitely, Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein were two of the most prominent people, really, on the planet that had been charged and actually convicted and sent to prison because of allegations that were made against them by various women. So, yes, it was a watershed moment. And so many people here in Hollywood today are just upset, surprised, and angry.
What about the reaction from the prosecutors or the woman at the center of this case?
Oh, she's been very, very upset. She released a statement saying she was surprised and she was angry. In addition to, remember, there are almost 60 women that ultimately came forward and accused Bill Cosby of having some sort of inappropriate touching or sexual assault or sexual harassment and being drugged against their will. Many of those women have either gone on television today or released some sort of statement saying they just can't believe they feel like they're being, you know, they're being re-victimized all over again with this latest ruling.
And this case, is it over or can it go to a higher court?
No, it cannot go to a higher court in the state of Pennsylvania. This criminal case is over. He will not be charged, nor will he go back to prison in the state of Pennsylvania. However, that does not mean that he's out of the woods yet. He still has a number of civil lawsuits, one by the famous attorney Gloria Allred here in Los Angeles, where she expects to depose him during a deposition in the coming months. So he still has to face civil lawsuits. And possibly, if any other state has enough information to bring forth in criminal charges against them, that could happen. Remember, a lot of this falls under the fact that the statute of limitations had run out in the state of Pennsylvania, not the case in certain other states. California most recently passed something saying that there is no statute of limitations when it comes to rape.
And KJ, describe that moment when he left prison. He didn't say anything to the waiting media, but how did he look and what did his representative say?
You know, he looked gaunt. People had heard that he was blind, that he was very ill. So I think they didn't expect him to say anything or do too much. So he did still look frail and he did still look weak. But to be honest, you know, looking at him, he looked to be in better condition. I know people, his attorneys and his management have said that he was blind, but he didn't appear that way too much. You know, he did stand out there at the podium next to his supporters and next to his lawyers. He didn't say anything, but he did raise his fist and say that he, you know, justice had been served. And of course, later that day, he released a statement basically saying, you know, in essence, that he still stands by what he said from the beginning, that he was not guilty, and yet he feels today he's been vindicated and justice has been served.
Now, you touched earlier on the reaction to this news and the news of his release in this instance. Take us through some of the individual responses, KJ, to Bill Cosby walking free from prison.
Well, you know, one of the biggest responses and basically backlash has come from his former castmate on the show, Cosby. You know, Felicia Rashad played his wife, and she was one of the first ones to release a statement in support of him saying, finally, a wrong has been righted. And immediately after that, a number of people attacked her and basically said that she wasn't supporting, you know, survivors of sexual assault. And even a university, Howard University in Washington, D.C., that was supposed to have her on to basically run their film and arts department, had to release a statement saying, you know, we stand by survivors of sexual assault. So many people said things. You had Rosie O'Donnell saying, you know, I guess 70 women weren't enough, you know, basically replying to all the women who had come forward and accused them. You had Ellen Barkin saying, you know, heartbreaking for all survivors, hashtag Me Too, lasts forever. You even had Deborah Messing, the actress, saying to every woman who was sexually assaulted by Bill Cosby, my heart hurts for you today, and I am full of fury. It's horrifying. So that's just a sample of some of the things that were said by a lot of prominent people here in Hollywood, and how there's just been tremendous backlash against this ruling and this decision on here on Wednesday.
KJ, the other matter I want to talk to you about is something that we started the week discussing on the programme with yourself, Britney Spears and her conservatorship. The judge has made a ruling. What happened?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people thought this was in response to what happened last week. Remember, Britney Spears basically had an audio conference call with the judge. It was more of a hearing where she expressed that she wanted her conservatorship to end, and she listed why. And she went on for about 20 to 25 minutes about, you know, how her life has just been miserable and it's horrible and all the things that have happened to her because of the conservatorship. Well, on Wednesday, a judge ruled not in response to whether or not the conservatorship should end, but rather as it still continues, the father will remain as a co-conservator, because that was another issue that Britney had. Britney Spears wanted her father to be removed as a co-conservator. So the judge only ruled on that portion today. So in the coming months, there will be another decision as to whether this conservatorship can end altogether, or maybe it'll just be modified.
So the decision to keep the father in there, Jamie Spears, as co-conservator, that doesn't impact the other decision, which is about the wider issue of the entire thing standing or falling.
Absolutely. What people have to understand, too, is that this conservatorship is really split in half. There is the part of the conservatorship that deals with her finances, and her father is a co-conservative along with another group called Bessemer Trust. They maintain they basically have the power of all of her finances, how things are paid, how much money she makes, all of that. But the other part of the conservatorship is more of her medical and mental health. What doctor she sees, when she goes to therapy, all of those decisions are made by another conservative of the court that is not related to Britney Spears. And so her father basically issued a statement saying he doesn't know anything about that. He's not over that part of the conservatorship. However, he would like the court to look into her concerns and make sure that she is being treated well. What Britney is ultimately saying is she doesn't want any psychiatric evaluations. She doesn't want any more hearings. She wants the conservatorship to end.
US entertainment journalist KJ Matthews on Today with Claire Byrne. And that's where I'll leave it. Chat to you tomorrow.